Agarwal has joined. Jamie, could you please take a roll?
Sure. Justice Hardesty?
Here.
Justice Silver?
Here.
Justice Stiglitch? John Arascata?
Here.
Judge Sattler is proxy for Judge Freeman?
Here.
Judge Herndon? Luke Prangaman is proxy for Chris Hicks?
Here.
Darren Imlay?
Here.
Mark Jackson?
Here.
Lisa Rasmussen? Judge Shirley? John Springate?
Here.
Thank you. Darren Imlay as proxy for Jonelle Thomas?
Here.
Chris Lawley is proxy for Steve Wolfson?
Here.
We do have a quorum.
Lisa indicated that she'd be joining the meeting about 12:15 to 12:20 because she's got a court hearing that's going on, and she expected to be out of that by 12:15 or so. So we'll defer a discussion on Rule 8, which has been the rule she's been marshaling until she arrives. As I indicated in my email to everybody, I really appreciate the fact that there are other demands on everybody's time than the demands or the issues created by this committee, but I will limit today's meeting to an hour and see if we can make some progress on some of these areas. And I want to extend my thanks and appreciation to John Arascata for blue lining the Bordere Rule, Rule 17, which we're going to start off with. Lisa's work, of course, on Rule 8. We can get through those. And then I also appreciate the drafts that were submitted by John Arascata and Chris on sentencing and continuances, and see if we can move through those as well. Those seem to be, to me, to be rather straightforward and benign, but obviously people may have comments or issues they want to raise. So let's turn to Rule 17 if we could, and that's under tab 10. You've all had the benefit of Mr. Arascata's blue line work. I find it to be in conformance with our previous discussions. Are there any comments, questions, edits from any of the members of the committee?
This is Christopher Lawley. I have some comment.
Okay.
With respect to Section 3, challenges to the veneer, I think...
Hold on just a second. Okay, yes.
I'm on page 46 and then jumping down to 47. 47 is the area that I'm concerned about. What this draft contains is substantive law regarding the standards for challenging the veneer. And just to make sure I wasn't losing my mind, I went through our minutes from the last meeting. And there was no discussion, no agreement to adding this sort of language in here. And I find it problematic for a couple of reasons. One, these are rules of procedure. These are not intended to be substantive rules. Number two, this area in particular is one that is evolving in the state. There have been very recent Supreme Court cases, Nevada Supreme Court cases on these sorts of, on this topic. And, you know, what happens when the Nevada Supreme Court changes the landscape, the rules in this area, and they're not in conformity with this rule. And so I just, you know, the substantive law exists out there. We don't need to put it into the rules of procedure. And I am opposed to including that language, specifically subsection B, sub 1, 2, and 3 as it's in here.
Okay. John, do you want to be heard on this?
Sure. And also, John Petty may want to add in, but in going back through the rule and doing research on regarding the areas we, and Mr. Lawley's right, this was not discussed at our last meeting. But in doing the research regarding a juror that's unable to continue to participate and putting that area together, I also ran into the whole area of challenging the veneer for cause. And this is the established case law regarding it, and the rule was lacking this area, and it's a very important part of the law as far as challenging the veneer panel regarding the fair cross-section of the community. And it goes directly to the controlling case, which is Williams v. State, and also Duren v. Missouri from the United States Supreme Court. And although Williams is a 2005 case, this is not an area as far as the three-pronged test, so to speak, for challenging the veneer for cause. I don't see that changing, and it should be part of the rule, you know, the rules of procedure on jury selection. I, quite candidly, I'm a little bit embarrassed that we didn't have it included originally, but willing to discuss it, but I think it's significant to have how a panel is challenged for cause.
Let me hold on a moment. Jamie, I got a text message from Justice Stiglitz. She's attempting to gain access to the meeting, and if it's been locked out, she won't be able to do that. Can you get a hold of Jason?
Yes.
I know she sent a text to Jason as well.
Okay, you know, I'll just...
Sharon Dickinson, I believe, is also trying to get in.
Okay, you know, I'll give him a call.
Okay.
I'm in. This is Lydia Stiglitz.
Oh, you got in, Justice?
I'm just on the telephone. I wasn't able to get in on the video. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. They are working to open it or do whatever is necessary to do to get you on this. So we've held the discussion, but if you have your notes in front of you, we're talking about Rule 17 under Tab 10. And I'd ask the question whether this is good to go. And Chris Lawley has pointed us to page 47 and expressed an objection to subsection B, which Mr. Escada and Mr. Petty added since the last meeting. And we'll return to the arguments here in a minute, but I think both, now that you're here by phone, hopefully you get on the...
Recording has started.
I think that, was it Sharon Dickinson also is trying to gain access to the meeting, I think?
Right. He's on it, Justice. He's working on it.
Okay, thank you.
Justice Hardesty, I'm here now. Lisa Rasmussen.
Hi, Lisa. How are you? Thank you.
Thank you.
Lisa, we are discussing page 47 of Rule 17 under Tab 10. I don't know, there may be other comments or objections to the blue line version of this rule that was circulated by John Arascata, but Section B has been raised as an issue by Chris Lawley, and Mr. Arascata has responded, but we'll circle back and get their shortened version of their concerns.
Justice Hardesty, this is Darren Emley. To me, it seems like it's consistent because in under number 3A, subsection I and double I, it talks about challenging the veneer, but there's no explanation about how the veneer should be challenged. But to me, it seems it would be consistent with the rule as to the process with the rest of the rule. So that's why I believe it should be in there, because it just creates consistency with the rest of the room.
And I inserted it where I did to address the fair cross section, because then I think shortly thereafter we then address BASIN challenges. And it, you know, the fair cross section is what a challenge to the veneer normally is, or a lack of a fair cross section of the community. And then it flows into the BASIN type challenges. So that's why it was inserted in there. It is the law of the state. It's the law of the U.S. Supreme Court and the Nevada Supreme Court. And it's a process, not a legal finding, so to speak. And that's probably the wrong terms to use, but it's the process that's established in how a challenge to a veneer panel regarding whether it's representative of a fair cross section of the community is in that veneer panel.
This is Luke Prangeman. I echo Mr. Lawley's objection and concerns. I think there's a fundamental difference in the rules between addressing the timing and sort of funneling the timing and the when and what of procedure versus including substantive provisions. And we haven't done that so far, included substantive provisions. I don't think this obviates the need to go to the case law, because there's still more to this substance that any judge or any practitioner who's looking to make a challenge or respond to the challenge or decide a challenge will have to go back and look at in the case law. But I don't think, moving far into the substance from procedure, I don't think it resolves anything in terms of allowing the practitioner to work without having to consult the case law. But I don't think it solves any, it goes beyond procedure and it doesn't solve any problems.
Justice Hardesty, this is Mark Jackson. I echo those same comments from Luke as well as Chris. And initially when I looked at this, it really stood out because it was something that was added. There's another section too where I have the same objections, but with respect to this one, again, there was no discussion. And when we get into the burdens and all that, we haven't done that in any of these other rules. Our pretrial motions, Rule 8, is pretty succinct. That could have probably been the lengthiest rule that we had done if we started getting into all the case law associated with these pretrial motions and burdens and everything that can happen. But we stayed away from that, and I don't think this should be part of this rule.
That doesn't create a burden. It establishes a process, and without it being there, we have this discussion on challenges to the veneer panel, but it's what type of challenges? And the primary challenge to any veneer is it's a not representative of a fair cross-section of the community. And so we should have the three-pronged procedural test or procedural process included within the rule as established under Williams and Dern v. Missouri.
Justice Hardesty, it's Justice Stiglitz. I didn't hear, obviously, Mr. Lawley's comments, but I don't see how necessarily this proposal is much different than how we lay out Batson, just a couple pieces below. So I'd like to hear what Mr. Lawley's concerns were, because I think it seems like a lot of people agree with him. I just want to know what the concerns were, because our Batson in the former C kind of lays out the steps in the same way that I think Mr. Arascotta and them are attempting to lay out challenge to the veneer in the new item B. So just let me know.
Just for the record, I am not supportive of having the Batson language in either. Again, because it's substantive. However, I just think Batson is so much more established and ingrained than this is. In a perfect world, I'd take both sections out. And, you know, I think we have to sort of choose our battles. But I just don't believe that this should be in here. In addition, when the elements are listed out, subsection 1, 2, and 3, legally those are in the conjunctive, and there's no indication in this rule. Do you just prove one of those? Do you prove two of them? Do all three of them have to be established? And so even if it were to be left in as it is, it's legally inaccurate.
Just so you know, it's pulled verbatim from the case law, so it's legally accurate.
Well, when I say inaccurate, and John, this is with all due respect, of course, I'm not suggesting you're trying to pull anything over on somebody, but they are conjunctive, so they're ands in between these various elements, and the way it is written does not convey that. So I still believe it should be removed. So please don't, John, don't take any offense by that comment.
This is what committees are about.
So anybody else have any comment on this addition to the draft? The one issue that I think I have a question about, because I didn't have a chance to pull up the cases, but I'm accepting that, and my memory is that what Chris has indicated does require that these are conjunctive. So at least the draft would have to demonstrate that if it is to be retained. My memory of the discussion about Batson was that I personally, at least, am very concerned about lawyers who miss the Batson issues and district court judges who miss the Batson issues and miss their challenges. So I felt that was a valuable procedural rule to have in these rules, because the consequence is so devastating. On the fair cross-section question, I don't disagree that these elements are the elements in a current established law. What I'm worried about is that, it's a fair point that this too needs to be alerted to both the court as well as the practitioners. But what I'm concerned about is the area is developing, there's lots of other aspects to fair cross-section determinations. Even the word distinctive as a state of the art or word of art is evolving. So that's of concern to me. I think maybe John, if you could comment about that. Jurisprudence that may be coming along and how that impacts the rule.
I'll take a stab first and then defer to John Petty, but Justice Harsey, I don't think the three-prong or three-step analysis is going to change. What is going to change is, as you said, how the word potentially change. What is a distinctive group? But this is just the bare bones. These are the areas that a practitioner should be aware of, and they can do then their additional research if they're raising a charge contesting the fair cross-section. They can do research on, all right, is this a distinctive group or not? Where does it play? But the framework that's exhibited here is not going to change. The definitions, as you mentioned, to say what is distinctive, that may change, but it allows the framework to be there and alerts the court and the practitioner that a challenge of a fair cross-section exists, and this is how you go about doing it.
This is John Petty. Just echoing what John said, you know, in the Batson arena, suspect classification started as a race topic. It expanded or was enlarged to gender issues. It was enlarged to sexual orientation. but the term suspect classification didn't change. What that embodied did through case law. So if you have distinctive, the word would be distinctive group in this particular rule, proposed rule, that comes out of the case law, the word itself isn't going to change in the rule, but case law may enlarge those categories that fall within the rule. I think this, and it's already been said, but I'll just reiterate it, I think this particular piece of the rule is sort of what we did with Batson now in subsection D, and it gives some guidance with regards to cross-section veneer challenges. So I'm not a voting member, but I support it.
Justice Hardesty, right. This is Alex Jen. Can I make a comment about it?
Yes, of course. Thanks.
Thank you. In terms of one of the things that Justice Stiglitz asked about the difference between the section on Batson challenges and then this section that we're discussing now, the Batson one does seem to give an actual process, though. I mean, we aren't used to the case law, but it gives exactly what happens first, what happens second, what happens third. I think the difference with the section that we're discussing now gives things that are kind of, you should pay attention to these things, but it's not really a process. I think even after Williams, the court recently came out with Valentin versus State, and that gives some more guidance about actual things that need to happen, which would be the point of a rule, I think. But I think that there's a distinction there, because this doesn't say anything about evidentiary hearings. This doesn't say anything about what order things should happen in, and I think that's what the rules are about more than things to generally look for. That's just my opinion.
So Alex, let me ask you this. Do you think that it is worthwhile to have a rule that the use of the word may suggests that it's discretionary, but it seems to me a challenge to the veneer must be made before they're impaneled?
Sure. And I think if the rule were something like that, I mean, it would give guidance that objection needs to take place at a particular point in time. I think that would make sense, but I would probably just leave it at that and not much more.
So what I was wondering about, both to John Ariscotta and John Petty, why wouldn't the rule be sufficient to say a party must contest the veneer's composition, that the veneer does not represent a fair cross-section at some point in time, and leave it at that? I mean, the point of the rule is to try to reduce or mitigate against errors, especially errors that are so serious and structural in nature. I think that there is value in a rule that alerts the practitioner that they got to do this and when they got to do it. And that seems to be consistent with the location of this issue in this rule. But I don't know off the top of my head whether any of this jurisprudence specifies what happens if you don't make an objection prior to the swearing of the jury, the selected jury. It seems to me that if you waive it if you don't make it. So if that's the case, wouldn't it be appropriate, because I'm also a little bit concerned about burden shifting and burden specification, I should say, and once we've alerted the practitioner that they must make this objection at this particular point, then all that does, once they start down that road, is it kicks in all the jurisprudence. You've got your bench books ready to go, and you're going to figure out what process to take. The judge is alerted to it, everybody else is.
I'm amenable to that, Justice Hardesty.
I think that's a good idea, Justice.
Chris, I know you object to this kind of subject being in the rules, but doesn't it make sense to alert the practitioner and the judge that if you're going to do this, you better do it before the panel gets passed?
I have no problem with that sort of an addition. I have no problem at all with that.
So, excuse me?
I can re-edit it and recirculate it unless you were gonna suggest differently, Justice.
No, that's fine. But I wanna be clear on when this, this must be made, and I want to be consistent with what Williams is, and I haven't looked at it in a while, but I want to make sure that we say a party must contest the veneer's composition, that the veneer does not represent a fair cross-section of the community under blah, 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 by or before the veneer or the jury is impaneled, something along those lines. And I want to take that language from the case law. And then the rest is,
I'm sorry, I would just point out in 3A subsection 1, it says the challenge to the veneer must be made before the jury is sworn and made upon the record. We added that in last time, so I agree that it's good to have it in there, and I would submit it is already in there.
Well, just to highlight the question, let's go ahead with the first sentence then and change made a must, and we're good to go. That seems to me anyway.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Sorry, I was late.
Sorry, Sharon, Justice, just going back to what, I didn't follow the amendment. What page are you on?
47B.
Okay, Justice, can I just ask you to look at 3A1 on page 46, because I think it already says must. I think the language you're looking at is already in the rule. So it's on page 46.
Well, how about this then? The point of this, though, is to alert the practitioner and the judge to a fair cross-section challenge. You can either leave this separately under B or under A1. You could say the challenge to the veneer, comma, including one for fair cross-section, must be made before the jury is sworn.
I have no problem with that.
Okay.
I can work with Justice.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. All right, then let's do that. I want to make sure everybody's had a chance to weigh in if they have objections or concerns, but that would be the edit, I think, that would be appropriate, and we would strike subsection B. Does anybody have further comment on that edit? Okay, then let's, Chris, you mentioned you may have another issue or two you wanted to raise.
Yes. So going down to page 50.
Yes, sir.
This is subsection 6, the language regarding seating an alternate juror. My recollection and the minutes from last time also suggest we were concerned about crafting a very specific language in this section. And I am concerned with what has resulted. We have language from the statute, and again, I'm not saying any of this is inaccurate. I just don't believe that it ought to be in the rule. I think the law in this area, based upon Norton Aurelian, I know I'm brutalizing that that case name, Carroll, Brake, and Simons, which are all the cases that were cited in the minutes. The sentence that is actually omitted or redlined out or blue lined out, if an alternate replaces a juror after deliberations have begun, the court shall recall the jury, seat the alternate, and instruct the jury to begin deliberations anew. That is the law, and all of those cases support that. And I have an objection to the language above that. I have an objection to now creating a mandatory instruction that has to be given. And so what if a jury is nevertheless instructed that they have to begin deliberations anew with the alternate seated, but it's not instructed exactly as this rule would say, using this precise instruction. So I object to that. I think the only language that's needed in the rule is actually what is proposed to be deleted here. And I think it really serves everyone's interest in doing that. What we want to do is all of us, we want to, it is in the interest of the criminal justice to preserve convictions if they are appropriately obtained. And I think when you put these extra requirements that are not part of our jurisprudence into rules, you are just asking for trouble. And so I would propose that the language, and I'm talking about the language starting, if an alternate juror is required to replace a regular juror. That language on down, I object to it. And I think just the language, the sentence that begins, if an alternate replaces a juror, I think that actually ought to be what the rule says.
This is John Arascotta. I was instructed to insert this language at the last meeting. First, the paragraph above, the sentence above, shall retain alternate jurors. We went through that discussion. Then I was asked to craft language consistent with Carroll, Martin, Norellen, and Brake. And in doing so, one thing I noticed was that when an alternate juror is seated, primarily the challenges come with how the court's admonishing the jury as far as what to do when a new juror is seated. So from that, I took the language from Brake, which was the admonition that Judge Steinheimer gave, and created the admonition so that we have consistency, because the challenge comes from, has the jury been properly admonished to start deliberations anew? And just like we have an admonition at every break of a trial, and the admonition of jurors when they receive a case and when they're sworn into a case, I think an admonition here will do away with unnecessary challenges when new jurors are seated.
Anybody else want to comment on this?
I just want to say that I think John is 100% correct. A lot of the cases I see, the big issue is how the admonishment was made. And so instead of saying shall, you could say may, if I don't know if that would solve the problem, but I do agree John is correct.
I think an admonishment is a good thing. I'm sorry, this is Lydia Stiglich. Having a proposed instruction, I can only speak for when I was on the bench doing trials, you want something in writing. The judges just want an instruction. So if we tell them this is the admonishment that you give if you get rid of a juror, that's helpful. I don't see how that's hurtful. And I think especially as we are right now in tandem creating past jurisdictions, if we do adopt an admonishment, we'll just extend that over to Judge Freeman's committee and that'll be going in. So I'm not sure what the concern is about having an admonishment unless there's some words wrong in the admonishment that you disagree with.
Judge Sattler and then Mark.
I was basically going to say what Justice Stiglich said, so I don't want to beat the proverbial dead horse, but I can tell you as a practicing district court judge, it's actually beneficial, and with all due respect to Mr. Lawley, I don't know why a judge would not give the instruction that has been articulated. It removes all question. If it's in the rule, then I don't know why any judge wouldn't simply just give the exact instruction. It eliminates any ambiguity. You just would say, give the instruction. So that was my only comment. Thank you.
Mark?
The last two lines that were struck, we spent a lot of time discussing that at not only our last meeting, the one before that, and part of the subcommittee that worked on this and discussions we had. And it's hard to read it this way without looking at a clean copy, but that rule needs to be there. Just putting this admonishment in doesn't take care of it. The problem that I have with this is it says the court shall admonish the jury as follows. So it would have to be basically verbatim. I wouldn't want an appellate issue being raised because a judge excluded a word. I think an admonishment along those lines would be sufficient, but I don't think it would have to be exactly word for word. So I have a problem with just the shall admonish as follows.
So Mark, I shared your point, and I believe I have an understanding of what Chris is trying to get at. The court has gone back and forth, as you probably know from our decisions, putting in exact language for instructions in some areas and not doing so in others. I think feedback that we get from practitioners is, and especially district court judges, they would like to have the instructions inserted in the decisions when it's appropriate, when the case calls for it. But I think one of the things that's beneficial is rather than getting into a slight word change, unless of course it's material, it would seem like the court shall admonish the jury substantially as follows. And then as long as there is a material compliance with the elements of the instruction, it would seem like one would be good to go, and it would reduce the risk of appellate error. I would think that this would be an area, once again, I look at the consequences of not admonishing, and it worries me that it results in an absolute reversal. And I don't want to see reversals occurring just because of a word change or something like that, unless it's absolutely material and the jury it disregards their obligation to deliberate anew. It just accepts what the prior panel has done and then just works on the remaining counts. I mean, that's been an ongoing discussion. So I would like to suggest or offer that the court shall admonish the jury substantially as follows, above the language that John has added to the rule. The last sentence is really in conformance with the sentence that leads up to the proposed instruction. So I don't know that there's much of a big change there. What's people's reaction to that suggestion?
Judge Johns, one comment I do have then is in section 10, we have an admonishment regarding recesses and breaks, and regard that admonishment that we are saying that judge shall during all recesses or breaks in the trial admonish the jury as follows, and we have a verbatim admonishment. So sure, for consistency, I think we should have a verbatim admonishment that the court, every judge can have there in his bench book, and when that event occurs where they have to replace a juror, he can read it verbatim, and then there's no issue.
I think the substantially word that you're proposing, Justice Hardesty, that allays my concerns. And I would use it in both areas, quite frankly.
Justice Stiglitz, were you trying to weigh in? I'm sorry.
Yeah, if I may, I disagree. I mean, why can't we just have a jury instruction that people read? And if there's an error, non-material, that's not going to be the type of thing that's going to flip a case. If somebody leaves out a blah, or they leave out an and, but if they leave out, you have to start your deliberations anew, yeah, that would be a problem. I think part of what this committee is trying to do and the other subcommittees is trying to corral the practice of criminal law and professionalize the practice of criminal law and standardize the practice of criminal law in the state of Nevada. So I don't know that, that substantially conforming just invites mischief, frankly. Just my thoughts.
This is Darren Emily. I agree completely. The more consistency that we have between all the rules just reduces the risk of errors. And so the more consistency that we have in all the admonishments, giving the admonishments, the consistency of the admonishments is best.
Okay, in the interest of time, Mark, go ahead.
Justice, going back to those last two lines, and you discussed that you think that what preceded the admonishment takes care of it. I would just ask that before that last sentence, it says the court shall admonish the jury as follows, that the sentence that currently ends the case to the jury, I would ask that you add to begin its deliberations anew. It's nowhere within the rule, it's only within the admonishment, and I believe it needs to be the rule.
Yeah, that's a very fair point.
And then in the middle of the admonishment, there's that long line after it says start a new period. I think it should say alternate juror blank must be part of the deliberations.
Okay, I just left that open so they could say if it's either alternate juror number one or Mr. Jones, the kind of the court's discretion, how they want to how a court handles their referencing of jurors. Do they call them juror one or do they call them Mr. Jones? That's why I left it as a blank.
Appreciate that, John. Thanks.
Okay. And your suggestion, Justice, you brought it up. I missed it. If I could have that again.
Actually, Mark made the point. If you take a look at the sentence that begins, that is before the court shall admonish the jury, and compare that sentence with the last phrase of the sentence that's stricken, the phrase instruct the jury to begin its deliberations anew is to be an element of the rule, and that isn't in the rule itself, it's only in the language that instructs.
Okay.
So
I agree, I can change, I can add that, I can move the sentences around.
So just to be clear, yeah, just to be clear what we're talking about, I mean, the easy solution is to just replace the sentence that precedes the court shall admonish with the last sentence below the language, and then you're done, because I think that captures everything.
Okay.
That fair enough?
With the admonishment.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know that we need a vote here, but we can have one if necessary.
Justice Horses. Yes, I was, and I'll be brief, but I was just going to suggest, I don't disagree with Justice Stieglitz, however, that a case would necessarily get flipped, but I do think that any opportunity for litigation will be taken, and I think that we should also consider that there's work involved, there's a burden on resources when issues are raised that have to be addressed. And so even though I don't disagree that a case may not be flipped just because there's a deviation from this language or a minor one, there still might be litigation and lawyers in my office, in the Clark County DA's office, in Mr. Jackson's office, they have to address that and spend time, regurgitating the case law, talking about prejudice, etc. And that could be an issue that's created. And I know it's easy to say, well, that'll never happen. But I think the reality is that the lawyers will argue anything that they think they have an opportunity to. So I would simply suggest that we say the court must admonish the jury to begin anew, and include that must admonish. Such admonishment may include the following or may be substantially in the following form. I think that alleviates all the concerns. It sets forth the requirement that there be an admonishment. It gives an example for judges to follow, but it doesn't set forth the requirement to follow that particular or even substantially follow that language.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Luke, but we have had several instances within the last decade in which statutes that spell out precisely what the hell's supposed to be done in selecting a jury were absolutely ignored by a trial judge, even over the protests of both lawyers. So I think if we had a rule here that says that no lawyers can ever argue against whatever's here, is going to be disregarded too. So I think I respect your point, and I am concerned about the fact that people would disregard rules, but it happens every day, and unfortunately having a rule at least provides guidance to the appellate court about what to do when you're faced with the situation, and should reduce the number of these circumstances. I would consider the cases I'm talking about to be an aberration with one judge. Unfortunately, it was repeated several times. You didn't see a lot of other judges doing that sort of thing. So anyway, I respect that, but I'd like to get a vote because I've got 15 minutes left to run this meeting. So would you please call the roll, Janie? The rule I'm suggesting is this. It's as drafted with one exception. The language that precedes the sentence, "the court shall admonish the jury," is substituted, replaced and substituted by the sentence that has been currently stricken after the proposed admonishment. Everybody clear on what the rule is? Janie, call the roll.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Justice Hardesty?
Yes.
Justice Silver?
Yes, with one question. We're replacing that, but we're also admonishing too. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, then yes.
Thank you. Justice Stiglitz?
I think she's
my phone. Sorry, I was on mute. Yes.
Thank you. John Ariscotta?
Yes.
Judge Sattler is proxy for Judge Freeman?
Yes.
Luke Brangleman is proxy for Chris Hicks?
No.
Thank you. Darren Imlay?
Yes.
Thank you. Mark Jackson?
Yes.
Lisa Rasmussen?
Yes.
Thank you. John Springate?
Yes.
Darren Imlay is proxy for Jonelle Thomas?
Yes.
And Chris Lawley is proxy for Steve Wolfson?
No.
The yeses have it, Justice.
All right. Chris, or anybody else, are there any other comments to the remainder of the rule?
An observation, Justice Hardesty, I don't mean to be super picky, but if we go back to page 49, under section M, regarding, we kind of just went right over the top of it, but regarding challenges for cause, in subsection M, it describes just newspaper accounts. And as I was reviewing it, I appreciate all the work everyone's put in, and I'm the new guy who just looked at it the first time, but we frequently discuss with jurors news media accounts, and with all due respect to the print media, we just don't see as much newspaper accounts. You might want to expand that to any type of media, or just change that language slightly. That was the only thing I saw. Thank you.
So could you look at the last five words after newspaper accounts or from other media exposure? Does that not address your concern?
It does, but then I don't know why you would reference newspapers. I mean, I just think it just needs to be an overall one kind of concept. But again, I'm late to the show, and so that was just an observation. Thank you.
No, that's fair.
Justice Hardesty?
Yes,
John Springate. I would have to agree with Judge Sattler on that one. If we change that first statement of newspaper and just said media accounts, that would embrace all sorts, including social media, which is an issue.
This is John Ariscotta. I'm okay with that. I can say that the reason a newspaper is in there is that Mark Jackson, and I drew this from, I think it was one of the statutes, a civil statute that is somewhat antiquated, or the last vestiges of it references newspapers, and that used to be the primary media that we had. So I think if we include, consistent with the admonition about the types of media there are, and they take out newspaper, I'm fine with that.
Justice Harsey, this is John Petty. I hate to be contrary, but there are some of us who still read the newspaper, and there are people out there who will read the newspaper. So if you take that out and you say other media accounts, that somebody out there might actually think, well, they're not talking about the newspaper, they're talking about electronic monitoring or electronic programs. So I would leave the rule as it is.
So let me offer this and ask if it streamlines the rule. If you begin with the line, for bias or opinion, unless the juror has formed a state of mind evincing enmity or bias based on any media exposure. Or preferring an active voice based on any exposure to the media, but I think it's better to say based on any media exposure.
I think that's good.
Any objections?
No.
Rob, did you get that edit, John Ariscotta?
I did.
Okay. Would you mind making that as well?
It will be done.
And then, Chris, I'm not sure we covered all of your questions, remaining questions.
So,
I'll circle back to you, and then we'll see if anybody else has any other questions or comments.
Thank you. I'm moving to section 7 on page 50.
Okay.
So a juror may not deliberate anew a verdict already reached or entered during the guilt phase of the trial that has been entered upon the record. I don't have a problem with that language. I do have a concern about the language that follows, and the jurors canvassed that the verdict is accurate. So as I read that, I'm thinking, okay, that's when the jury is polled. So if a verdict comes in and neither the defense nor the prosecution asked to have the jury polled, and the judge doesn't do it on his or her own, is that then not a final verdict? Because that's certainly not the law. So I would strike the language in that sentence that starts at "and."
The fair point.
Just a statement. Yeah, I agree with Mr. Wally. I agree with Mr. Wally.
I'm okay with that.
Okay, so we'll strike the language unless somebody else has a further comment. And the jurors canvass that the verdict is accurate. Okay, Chris, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, that's all I had, and I just wanted to thank everybody for indulging me on this rule.
No problem. All good points. Did anybody else have any comments to this rule?
This is Sharon. I had a comment, if I may.
Okay.
The only thing that I found a little confusing is under subsection 3, there's challenges to the veneer or individuals. And then when you go to subsection 4, it starts talking about peremptory challenges, which are challenges to the individual. And subsection 5 says challenges for cause, which are also challenges for the individual. So I didn't know if maybe subsection 3 should just be challenges to the veneer, and then the next subsection challenges to the individual that has everything under it.
Sharon, are you just talking about the title of the section?
Yeah, I'm just talking about the structure with the title, because subsection C says challenges to the veneer or individuals, but then when you go to other subsections, you're also talking about challenges to individuals, which are peremptory challenges or challenges for cause. So I'm not talking about the content, I'm just talking about the way it's structured in the rule.
Well, Sharon, just so you know, that section that's the veneer and individuals, that's because it includes a Batson challenge, which would be a challenge regarding an individual for race-based or other reasons. So that's why it says the veneer or individuals and individuals.
What about, to Sharon's point, maybe, this is Jesse Stiglitz, sorry. Item 3, do challenges to the veneer, do a new heading before what is on page 47C. Challenge individual veneer. And then Batson can be a section, peremptory challenges can be a section, and challenges for cause can be a section. Underneath challenges to the individual jurors.
I think I'm okay with that.
I don't have an objection to that.
Yeah, I think
Eddie nodded his head in approval, so I am okay with it.
Okay, then let's approach it that way, John, since you're having to make some additional edits here. Do you mind sending to Jamie, accept all the other edits, and then insert a new red line or blue line or however you do it, with the edits we've agreed upon today, and then we can ask everybody to respond by an email vote to this rule so we can move past that.
Yes.
I'd like to ask, I know this is, it's 1:02, I've got 3 minutes left, but let me just ask if anybody had a question or a comment concerning tab 9 and rule 8. Once again, it looked to me like the edits that Lisa made were consistent with our discussions. I'd like to see if we can move past this rule as well. Is there any comment to Rule 8 that was modified by Lisa?
This is Christopher Wallach. I think I just, there's a small typographical error on page 35.
Okay.
And it is in the paragraph that starts hearing of motions in the 8th Judicial District Court.
Okay.
I think it should be, it's the third line down, merits at any time after a reply is filed or after the time for filing should be a reply. Just a small typo there.
Fair enough. Any other edits or changes to Lisa's revisions?
Hi, this is Sharon Dickinson. I had thought that we were going to change, which is now subsection 8 and triple little I's on bail. Because when I went through my notes, I had indicated that I think Luke Pregerman was going to submit something on that section, and we were going to revise it so that it corresponded with the new case that came out on pretrial bail.
That's correct, and Luke didn't send me anything, so I submitted it without any changes to that, because I'm not quite sure how it should be changed based on Valdez.
Luke, did you were you aware of that assignment, or did you have time to look at it? Luke, are you still on the call?
He obviously knew this was coming, and he got out of Dodge.
He bailed. that would be unfair. We'll send him an email, and I'll ask him if he had a chance to look at that or not, and we'll defer on that point until the next meeting. Anything else on this rule?
No, I don't think so, but if the Public Defender's Office has proposed changes, I'd accept those as well. I just didn't know how people wanted it changed.
We'll get something.
Yeah,
we'll get something to you, so we weren't able to.
Can you do that, Darren, before our next meeting on the 8th or 9th or so?
We'll try to make that happen, yes.
Okay.
I have another question on this rule, if I may. I received a proposal on submissions. I think that there was a whole section that I got with the documents in this for today, and I didn't know if that was supposed to fit in with the pretrial motions or not, because we have a section of submissions in the pretrial motions. I think Elisa put together a paper on submissions.
I don't know what you're talking about, Sharon, but...
Oh.
Could the two of you confer offline, and let's come back to this question, if it is a question, at the next meeting?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Were there any other questions about this rule beyond the two that have been identified by Sharon? All right. Then we'll revisit this rule with the Vail's suggested input at the next meeting. It's 1:07. I'm 2 minutes over. So we will reconvene at our next meeting date. Jamie, what's that one?
Our next meeting is the 27th, which means I'm going to need meeting materials by the 22nd.
Okay. All right, so John, if you can submit the red line changes to 17, and Darren and Sharon, you'll need to get your input to Lisa well before the 22nd if you can.
Okay. Will do.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody. I appreciate your cooperation. Have a nice weekend, and we'll be seeing you on the 27th.
Thank you.
Bye.
Stay safe,
everyone.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye. Recording has stopped.